flashpoints. We'll speak to investigative reporter Alan Naren live in Indonesia about an Indonesian military assassination program against dissidents. And we'll also speak with Robert Perry about the politics of healthcare coverage in the media, that is. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Investigative reporter Alan Naren recently broke a story of assassinations by the Indonesian military. According to Naren's story, and he says, according to senior Indonesian officials and police and details from government files, the U.S.-backed Indonesian Armed Forces, TNI, now due for fresh American aid, assassinated a series of civilian activists during 2009. Alan Naren, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Lay out the story. Give us the thumbnail sketch. What happened here?
Well, I'll try to speak quickly because I have to move on in a few minutes. The Indonesian military, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people in its decades of being armed and trained by the U.S., is still doing so. They have a program of assassinating civilian activists. In Aceh, in the western part of Indonesia, in 2009, at least 8 activists for the Partai Aceh, the pro-independence party, were murdered. These murders were carried out according to a senior Indonesian official who meets frequently with the president of Indonesia, at the orders of, as he put it, higher-ups in Jakarta. They included the assassinations of 2 men, which I detail. One was a man named Tumi John, who was abducted. His body was found in a sewage ditch. He was bound with electric wire. His throat was slashed. His body was mutilated. The other was the assassination of a man named Abu Karim, who was sitting in his car outside his house. A man walked up with a pistol, put 2 bullets in his head. In the case of Tumi John, the assassinations were coordinated by a general named General Sunarko, a Kopassus general. Kopassus is the special forces of the military. President Obama wants to boost aid to the Indonesian military, restore aid that was cut off by Congress as a result of grassroots pressure, and in particular, he wants to fully restore aid to the Kopassus. The Indonesian military and Kopassus are salivating at this prospect. They see it as their vindication, and the survivors of terror by the military are worried about this. They view it as a green light from Obama for further terror if he goes ahead with this aid increase. In response to my piece, which has created an uproar within the Indonesian government, the military says they've officially announced they want to have me jailed, arrested for the crime of defiling the good name of the Indonesian Armed Forces.
Which is why you have to keep moving, Alan Naren. Just finally, on the killings that took place in 2009, were these targeted killings against people who were trying in one way or another to hold the Indonesian government accountable for its claims of democratic rule?
Well, in a sense, they were members of a party which had historically advocated independence for Aceh, and the president of Indonesia, General Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, has made it clear that no one is allowed to speak publicly about the topic of independence for any region, be it Aceh, West Papua, the Maluku's. That is officially defined as a crime, as a speech crime. In fact, in the Maluku's, they even arrested dancers who held up symbols. About mere symbols about independence for their region. That appears to be the motive behind these assassinations by the army. I spoke to General Sunarko, the man who coordinated the assassinations in the army region. He acknowledged to me that some of his men were involved in the assassinations, but then he said, well, even if TNI, Indonesian military officers and men, engage in assassinations, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the fault of TNI as an institution. The general also said that he was a big fan of President Obama's plan to fully restore the arms and training to the Indonesian armed forces. And he said that he himself was a U.S. trainee. He said they had been training him since the 1980s, that mobile training teams from Pacific Command in Hawaii had been coming in, training him in everything from jungle warfare to logistics. And I want to say, regarding the threat of the Indonesian military to arrest me, I welcome it. I say that since they claim that I have defamed them, they should arrest me. And we will face off in open court. And in court before the Indonesian public, I will speak about their role in assassinations, disappearances, massacres. I will attempt to call TNI generals as witnesses. I will also attempt to call under oath people from the U.S., CIA, Pentagon, State Department, and White House, and ask them under oath why they have been arming and training this military, even as it has been assassinating civilians, even as it has continued to assassinate civilians while President Obama has been in the White House.
And have they responded? Have U.S. officials responded?
Not that I've seen, but there have been so many news reports on this the past days. I've only been able to see a fraction of them, so I don't know.
All right.
I do have to go now.
All right. That's Alan Marin talking to us somewhere in Indonesia. Thank you for being with us, Alan. Be careful.
Okay, thanks. You're welcome.
All right. Alan Marin on the run. In Indonesia, somewhere outside of Jakarta, reporting an extraordinary story about the killings, based on documentary evidence. The reporting that Alan Nguyen does is always based on in-depth documents, reporting, background interviews, so you can put a lot of weight behind this story. As you heard, they want to arrest him in Indonesia, and he's ready for the fight. We're going to continue talking about this story, and delighted to have with us John Miller. John Miller is the National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. Miller is closely following the situation here and in Indonesia and East Timor. John, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, you heard Alan. He has once again broken a very important story that is consistent in the sense that it demonstrates that the Indonesian military, despite the illusion of democracy and elections, is still willing to kill in a serial fashion its opponents.
Yes, the Obama administration and President Obama gave an interview to Indonesian TV just before his trip was postponed again, before the health care vote, and which he said, and Hillary Clinton before him had said, human rights violations are in the past. And yes, there's still a problem of accountability for those human rights violations, but this is a new, reformed Indonesian military. And Alan's reporting, information we get out of particularly West Papua, which is the main ongoing conflict area in Indonesia, and there's a report by Human Rights Watch early last spring documenting not killings, but Kopassus abuses in a town in West Papua where they were harassing and arresting civilians with no legal authority. So while there were some reforms, particularly in the immediate aftermath of Suharto's fall, I think everybody, even supporters of the Indonesian military, would say that at best reform has stalled. And I think from our perspective, things have been moving backwards, particularly as the U.S. has intensified its relationship and restored its relationship with the Indonesian military.
Now, is this profound ignorance and insensitivity on the Obama administration? It does appear that on the national security foreign policy front, this is, in a way, an expansion of Bush policy.
It's interesting, particularly when it comes to training COPASAs. It's something the Bush administration, at least overtly, would not do. Bush met with Udiono, the president of Indonesia, and promised him there would be no more restrictions on U.S. military assistance to Indonesia. I think this was back in 2007, six or seven. And in 2008, the Bush State Department made a push, like the Obama administration is making a push now, to reengage with COPASAs. And the State Department's own legal counsel said, no, you can't. It would violate the Leahy Law, which essentially says the U.S. should not train units of Indonesian, of foreign militaries that have been credibly accused of human rights violations where there's been no action to deal with those violations. And they said COPASAs as a whole fits that definition. And since last summer when the Obama administration began talking about reengaging COPASAs, they've been, from what we can tell, looking for the loophole in the Leahy Law. So the latest idea they've been floating, and fortunately some in Congress are resisting even that, is that they would pick a few very young COPASAs officers that could not have been around when human rights violations were taking place, and train them. They would be untainted, and we could inject them with U.S. values of human rights and civilian control. And clearly, if we have documented abuses, at least up until the middle of last year, these officers would have to be very young and fresh recruits, even to fit that definition.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're talking, we've just finished speaking with Alan Narin. He is on the run, on the ground in Indonesia. The government there, I guess, wants to take him into custody and investigate a story that he broke about the Indonesian military and officials killing, a program of killing that took place against civilian activists in 2009. And John Miller, Alan Narin is in real danger. He spent about 9 or 10 minutes with us. He can't really stay in the same spot too long. Tell us about the importance of this story and why he may be in jeopardy.
It's interesting to watch the Indonesian official reaction because, frankly, it's the kind of story that might have come and gone. It's had no impact on the U.S. press yet outside of shows like yours and Democracy Now! And some progressive blogs. But the reaction from the Indonesian officialdom, and it's not just the military spokespeople, it's the foreign ministry, it's the president's office, to me says that they're very concerned that this will have an impact on what they see as the normalization of the U.S. Indonesian military relationship. And they're hugely overreacting. The initial stories from a few days ago said, here's Alan Narin presenting a story with no evidence. And he's got major and senior officials from the military and police on the record in his stories. And it's even very confused what they want to charge him with. My understanding of Indonesian law, which I will admit is extremely limited, but we've been looking into it, is that an institution can't bring criminal defamation charges against somebody. Like an individual can bring charges against somebody else for defamation, and the defamation law is often used in cases like this where somebody is trying to expose official malfeasance or corruption. In fact, the major targets of the defamation law in order are anti-corruption activists, journalists, and human rights defenders. But I believe institutions can sue, bring a civil case for defamation in the Indonesian civil courts, which can be serious too. And if the Indonesian military wants to keep this an issue in the headlines, they would, yes, file the charges, and there are plenty of prosecutors that will follow the Indonesian military's will, bring him to court. Alan's ability to kind of put on the, kind of turn the tables and make it a trial of the TNI and their backers in the U.S. is probably would be limited, but it would certainly keep the issues in the headlines. In the past, Alan's been, I think, arrested three or four times, detained before in Indonesia, and each time they've pretty much ended up deporting him. But there is also the possibility they might bring immigration charges against him, since I highly doubt.
How long has he been in Indonesia?
I try not to pay attention to those things.
All right, skip that question. I'm taking it back. Let me ask you this. How do people, what's the best way for people to follow his work on these kinds of investigations?
Well, he has a blog, alannairn.com. We're also posting most of the stuff on our website.
And how do people go there?
ETAN.org. And we're also, I think, you know, there's the danger to Alan, but there's the issue he's raising. And we've been, had a petition going since last summer to the Obama administration opposing COPASA's training. And people can go to our website, link to that, and sign it. And I think, you know, in the next few days, we'll probably start something directed at Congress as well. But as far as we know, the decision has not been made yet whether to, in the package of goodies that Obama will be offering Indonesia when and if he makes this visit, to include COPASA's training. As of right before he canceled the trip, administration officials were saying that they were still trying to work it out with congressional opponents. So this is still an open issue, and our hope, and I'm pretty sure Alan's hope, is that what he's written about will help us block this, you know, this last piece of engagement that's been restricted with the Indonesian military, because the fear is that this will be seen by the Indonesian military, where even if they only train a couple officers, as the final, as a vote of confidence in business as usual by the Indonesian military, which the Indonesian military doesn't see as their, you know, their willingness to bow to reform or occasionally prosecute one of their own for human rights violations, but for engaging in the kind of behavior that Alan is describing.
And if you could just say a little bit more about the people who gets killed in Indonesia, who was killed, what were they doing in 2009?
I think first of all, one thing that has changed in the last decade is a lot fewer people do get killed by officialdom in Indonesia, which is a good thing. They were, as Alan said, the party Aceh was the successor to GOM, who were the people that signed the peace agreement with Indonesia after the tsunami. GOM was the guerrilla movement in Aceh fighting for independence. They are the dominant political party in Aceh as part of the agreement. Local political parties were allowed in Aceh, which is they're not allowed actually anywhere else in Indonesia. And these were party activists, kind of grassroots canvassers, from what I understand, you know, low-level party workers. GOM and its successors have kept their word. They have not campaigned for independence since they signed that agreement, since they took charge of the Acehese government. On the other hand, the Indonesian government has not kept its word about 2 points in that peace agreement. One has to do with forming a truth commission to document what happened during the years of conflict in Aceh before the tsunami, or to form a human rights court to hold accountable those who might have committed human rights violations or war crimes during the conflict. And the Indonesian military, while it went along with the peace agreement, has never believed that, and it's still in their statements, even to this day, they've never believed that GOM turned party Aceh and has changed its true beliefs, its heart. These people still want independence, and that given enough time and freedom, they will revert back to their separatist ways. And I'm sure that many in their hearts still do want independence, but I think they are people of their word, and they have kept it. And in a sense, it's another way that the Indonesian military overreacts to situations, and particularly situations they don't have full control over, such as a free and fair election, which is what happened in Aceh.
All right.
That brought the party Aceh to power.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there, John Miller. Thank you for helping to fill in the background and all the incredible work you've been doing for so many years, working as coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesian Action Network, coming out of the East Coast. Alan Naren, somewhere in Indonesia, breaking once again incredibly important story. We thank you and, of course, him for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having us.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In one moment, Bob Perry is going to join us to talk about the politics of media coverage of healthcare, I guess is what I mean. Stay with us, listening to Flashpoints. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're joined by Robert Perry. He's the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He writes in a piece he put up on the site today, "Perhaps nothing measures the imbalance of media and political power in the United States better than the decision-making by major news organizations about when to issue corrections." Now, this is a look, Bob Perry, at how they make the corrections, whether they come on the left or the right. Talk about this.
It's one of those things that many news organizations don't like to do, make corrections. But you certainly see that the folks on the right have a great deal more leverage, it seems, than anything from the left. The piece I did today looks at the New York Times' very grudging partial apology for its mishandling of the Acorn story. The Times is certainly not alone in that. But the story about the undercover video was something that the New York Times did play up. They like much of the rest of the major news media, accepted the right-wing undercover video as real. They accepted it as presenting a factual case, not a clip job, basically, where scenes were put together in order to make the Acorn workers look as bad as possible. Obviously, the key point was that the New York Times accepted the notion that this right-wing young right-wing operative had gone into the Acorn offices dressed in this elaborate pimp costume, which he didn't. And there have been efforts by Brad Freeman and Friedman of Bradblog.com and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting to get the New York Times to acknowledge that it had not done the proper research on this story and to run a correction. The other, I think, even more outlandish or harmful mistake that the Times and others made was to accept this notion that the Acorn workers were essentially complicit in a plan to use underage Salvadoran girls as prostitutes. A review of the fuller transcripts show a very different story, that these undercover right-wing imposters presented this as a way to protect these girls from an abusive pimp situation they were in. So it was a much more complex situation than was presented as the major media, including the New York Times, just bought into this this very salacious presentation that these right-wing operatives made. So, but it's been very hard to get any kind of correction or apology from the Times. Finally, on Sunday, the public editor Clark Hoyt, you know, very grudgingly and still not willing to really accept how badly it was bungled, did acknowledge that the Times had been somewhat duped. Finally, the Times ran a very short and also somewhat misleading correction on Tuesday morning. So you had so when I was looking at that correction, I also noticed that they had run a correction on former House Speaker Newt Gingrich's comments relating to how President Lyndon Johnson had shattered the Democratic Party for 40 years by his actions back in the 60s. And this had been interpreted by the Washington Post and then carried over by New York Times columnist Paul Krugman as a reference to Johnson's support for the Civil Rights Act of 64. And that is that's a pretty obvious reference. I mean, that is what people say. That's how Johnson ended up causing the Democratic Party to lose the South. The Democratic efforts on behalf of civil rights were exploited by Richard Nixon and his Southern strategy, and then on really from there to the present, which is why the Republicans now dominate in the South. But Newt Gingrich did not like that interpretation of his words or the context, so he insisted apparently on a correction, which said that he was referring to the Great Society programs, which sort of makes no sense at all, especially since the major Great Society program was Medicare, which now even the Republicans seem to be defending against supposed cuts during this health reform debate. So it sort of shows how quickly and easily the New York Times is willing to run a correction on something on behalf of Newt Gingrich, where Newt Gingrich was, in my view, basically covering up what he had really meant, which was a reference to the Civil Rights Act, but how grudging and how difficult it was for people to get even a partial correction relating to Acorn. which has suffered horribly, in fact, has essentially gone out of business after 40 years of representing the poor and the powerless in this country.
And, I mean, it is also a fact that when it comes to protests, the media, the so-called liberal media, loves to cover the Tea Pot activists, the Tea Party activists, but they don't like, they're much more frightened of the left and covering a left protester or even acknowledging that they exist.
Well, as you know, I was in the mainstream media for most of my career, for AP, Newsweek, PBS, Bloomberg. And what I saw there was a real fear on the part of much of the mainstream press of being accused by the right of being liberal. That was the characterization that really scared many journalists and news organizations. And so I think the New York Times, which does get labeled as the liberal New York Times, is therefore very sensitive to any complaints from the right, and is very fast in running out even misleading corrections that the right demands, but has no real fear of the left in the same way. There's nothing the left really can do that would hurt the New York Times, in part because the progressive side of American politics is not as well organized in media as the right is. There's been billions of dollars poured in by the right to build this media infrastructure, which they now have, which covers everything from books to newspapers, magazines, to radio, TV, and the internet. It's just a vertically integrated conglomerate at this point. And it also has special groups that go and attack journalists, Accuracy in Media, Brent Bazell's organizations, which also are extremely well-funded. So you have a lot of fear in the mainstream press about being attacked from the right. So when the right has something that they're complaining about, there's a tendency to bend over backwards to give them their way. Conversely, there's no such fear in the mainstream press toward the left, because it just can't hurt you. And so there's this other approach, which is to essentially ignore their complaints, even when they're very well founded.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that's the voice of Robert Perry. He is the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. .com, right? Yes?
Right, it's .com. Yes.
ConsortiumNews.com, getting old here. Bob Perry, as he said, has spent many years in the mainstream working with the big press and knows a lot about these stories look like from both sides. Now, you had a piece yesterday, Bob, dealing with the coverage around the medical, all the stuff around the health care bill, and the way in which you write about how it's covered as if there are two legitimate sides and that the Republicans really have many, many concerns about the content and are not, in fact, engaged in a full-fledged program to scorch earth the policy and use it as an election tool for the upcoming congressional elections. It seems like there are just two sides who have different views of health care.
Well, what's so stunning, and I must say I happen to be watching Brian Williams' NBC Evening News on the day of that this law was signed, and what everyone thinks of the Health Care Reform Act, it is a significant piece of legislation and will affect Americans fairly profoundly in many ways.
For many years,
assuming it doesn't get repealed, or struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the amazing coverage of this by NBC, and this is not they were not alone in how they handled it. It was almost an entire segment. The first 10-15 minutes of the broadcast. Providing essentially what the Republican National Committee might have written as a script. They didn't really tell what the bill did or what the law did. They kissed off the signing ceremony and went right to these Republicans and how they're representing the mass of the American people who want this thing stopped. Kelly O'Donnell interviewed Senator DeMint. And DeMint sort of was presenting this entirely as a principled stand by the Republicans. she didn't bother, at least, or they didn't bother to broadcast if she had a question like, didn't you say this would be President Obama's Waterloo and that you would break him? It was him a natural question to ask, but the whole presentation was not that the Republicans were engaged in an effort to win back political power. It was all done as if they were standing up for some high principles. And I don't know what all they're thinking that's going on, but certainly politics has played an important role in this. And to present the Republican Party as simply engaging in a principled battle for freedom in America is disingenuous and bad journalism. And to have it be so one-sided, their vox populi, they went out and found one couple, near Oklahoma City, husband and wife. It wasn't like even two people. It was a husband and wife who spouted more Republican talking points. It was the most extraordinary. Perhaps not the most extraordinary, but it was a very extraordinary example of how many of these major news outlets just bend over backwards to appease the Republicans and the right. That really is the sensitivity that many people in mainstream journalism have. They're very afraid of being attacked by the right. A lot of careers have been ruined that way. And I think in the case of General Electric and NBC that there may also be a strong ideological component. We've been seeing recently, every time we turn the television on, General Electric advertising or saying how it is sponsoring the Ronald Reagan Centennial Celebration next year.
I saw that.
And so you have...
General Electric.
At this point, they still own NBC. They are trying to sell a majority stake to
General Comcast. Electric does, yes. Yeah.
So here you have General Electric essentially doing these pay-ons to this politician who had worked for General Electric and who really had created the momentum starting in the early 1980s for the kind of favoritism for the wealthy that America has become, going after the unions, breaking down the middle class, deregulating so much of the business sector, and with extraordinary consequences, as well as also running the country pretty deeply into debt during those 12 years of Reagan and Bush 1, and then of course Bush 2. But so you have General Electric taking this role in essentially holding Reagan up as one of the great presidents of all time, General Electric's network essentially carrying the ball into the present day by taking the Republican side on health care reform.
All right, Bob, we just have a couple minutes left, but I do want you to talk about this. Now, it does seem like the networks and CNN and, of course, Fox, predictable, that they're trying to cover up for the brutality that has come out in recent days regarding the people involved in the Tea Party movement. Now, this is some pretty serious stuff they're saying, and we're hearing, oh, yeah, a few people, a couple of bricks through a few windows, a couple of slurs here and there, but this is emerging as a pattern, at least in a core minority of this movement, that are still founded in the sort of like religious right-wing racist movement.
Right, and this is also something you can trace back to that period of the Southern Strategy. Remember when Ronald Reagan launched his general election campaign in 1980, he did it from Philadelphia, Mississippi, and gave a speech on states' rights. That, of course, is the location where the three civil rights workers were murdered back during the voter registration days. So you've had this pattern of violence, which is certainly part of the American picture, primarily from the right, one has to say. Not to say there haven't been examples of this from the left. There certainly have, but in recent years, it's been primarily from the right. And we had back in the early part of the Clinton years, we had the same sort of passionate hatred that was being whipped up toward a Democratic president. The militia movement had gotten big. People at that time said, oh, it doesn't matter that much, even though Rush Limbaugh and G. Gordon Liddy and other talk radio people were kind of egging this all on. And in the minds of a couple of sick people, it ended up leading to the destruction of the federal building in Oklahoma City on April 19th, 1995. So these are not paranoid fears. We've also seen this current wave of violence building up since last summer. This has now been 9 or 10 months of this kind of increasing anger, wild rhetoric, fed again by the right-wing media and especially talk radio, but also Fox News. So it's not something that should be completely dismissed. One certainly hopes it doesn't go to that next level, but it's certainly playing with fire.
All right. Robert Perry, ConsortiumNews.com, an incredible website if you want to read interesting, important news, creative, investigative reporting. Thanks, Bob, for being with us on Flashpoints again.
Thanks, Dennis.
And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.